Well, big happy Father's Day to all you fathers out there, and happy Father's Day to me. There was a dad, and he was doing dad stuff on a Saturday. You know, you work all week, and Saturday you do dad stuff. And it was kind of that time in life where you bring your eight-year-old son along to do dad stuff with, and there's all kinds of mentoring opportunities in that. So they're, you know, they're fixing things, getting the tools out, and the kid's getting the tools for his dad, and then cleaning up leaves and all that, and they're like almost done, and the kid jumps up on the trampoline and kind of looks up at the sky and says, "Dad, why are we here?" And his dad goes, "Well, okay, here's an opportunity, right?" And so he launches into this spiritual meaning of life. You know, God has created us to be his children, and he loves all people, and this is why he made us to love us and to love him and to make a positive difference in the world. And he's going on for a while, and then he says, "Does that answer your question?" And his son goes, "No, Dad. Why are we here? Were you even supposed to pick Mom up an hour ago?" My brother told me a couple of years ago, he never goes to church on Father's Day. And I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, because on Mother's Day, we celebrate the moms and talk about how much value moms have. And on Father's Day, they just tell you how to be a better dad." And, you know, like, I don't need that. And so I'm going to try not to do that today. You know, Father's Day it's sometimes challenging when people, you know, don't have a good dad or dads are imperfect. And I know, like, as I've grown older, I've kind of realized how much my dad was imperfect. But it was when I got married and when I had kids that all of a sudden it clued in how much my dad meant and was there in spite of all his imperfections. And it can be tough if your dad isn't there or if your dad is imperfect. And I mean, every dad's imperfect. It's tough now that my dad's kind of like slipping away to Alzheimer's. It's kind of hard to have a conversation with him about that. So what do you do? I mean, in my life, I've been blessed to have, I don't want to say surrogate dads, but other role models. I know my father-in-law is premium role model of what it means to be a dad. And I can't blame my dad for the way he is. He kind of grew up during the war in Holland. He's smaller than all of his other family members because he was really malnourished during the war. His dad died when he was, you know, I don't know, 15 or something like that. He became the man of the house just like that with five or six brothers and sisters, one of whom had psychological issues. 2 years ago or last year, my dad was diagnosed with depression, but he had it all his life. And so I grew up with a dad who was, you know, emotionally distant, physically unexpressive. My earliest memories of my dad is taking a nap on the couch after work. He's there, but he's not there. And so I've been fortunate to have other dads to look to. Had a strong mentor when I was out west, a pastor of a church named Dennis, who really poured into me. And so we have this kind of mess in our lives where we have a dad we can or can't look up to. Maybe there's other options. And I've come to realize in my own struggles to be a dad how difficult it is to be a good dad. Because, and I'm not saying it's easy to be a mom, it's really not, but I think it's more obvious on what a good mom is, and it's less obvious what a good dad is. I mean, it's pretty obvious what a bad dad is. And so some of us, you know, like me, grew up with a dad who's emotionally distant, physically unexpressive. Other people have it worse than me. They've grown up with dads who are not there at all. Like they, either through their own volition or through accident, they've passed on. And even worse, dads that are abusive and neglectful and all of that. And so what do we do with that? And here's why it's so difficult, because your first perception of who God is comes from your understanding of who your dad is. And God, here's why even the best dad falls short, because every person is individual. We have two kids, they're wildly different, and I can't behave exactly the same with either of them because their needs are different, and every one of us is an individual. And the dad struggles to be that to everybody. There's always something missing, because to be a really, really good dad, you have to be absolutely perfect like our Father in heaven is perfect. That's impossible. It's impossible. But see, we have a perfect parent, our Creator, God. And so I want to share a story out of Scripture this morning. It's one of the texts of the Bible. It's the book of Luke, which is towards the back end. And it's a story that Jesus tells. And it's a story that has kind of three levels of recognition, okay? Some people might recognize the name and only the name of the story. The story is the prodigal son. Usually for most people, that conjures up an image of like the black sheep of the family, the one that goes bad. For those of you who are a little bit more familiar, that you might understand the story of the dad and the two sons. And as you get more into it, you understand some of the cultural background. It just kind of opens up with a whole bunch of meaning. And why do I want to tell this story? Because the story is not the story of the prodigal son. It's not. Jesus doesn't say, here's a story about a son who went bad. Jesus said, here's a story of a dad. So it's found in Luke chapter 15. I will say that on a weekly basis, there's like this Bible app we encourage people to get on your phone, smart device, or whatever. And there's a like a live event feature, and there's always kind of where do we go from here questions to apply that to our life. And there's also usually on a Sunday, I don't think we'll have time to do it today, but I'll entertain like text message responses. If you have a comment or a question specifically related to the message, we actually do that within what we're doing here this morning, but we'll probably do that again next week. But I'm gonna jump into the story. So, Jesus tells the story. A man had two sons. The younger son told his father, I want my share of your estate now before you die. I don't know what you think about that. In the very first sentence, all of a sudden, there's a huge problem. Basically, what this son is telling his dad, I would like to live as if you are already dead. I want my inheritance now. And really, when you look at the strict rules of the culture, there was an understanding of high respect for, you know, the paternalistic head of the family, and there were rules. I don't know if they were ever enacted, but there's a rule set of when you strongly disrespect your father, you know, we could take you outside the town and kill you. Like, it was that strong. And so the son says this shocking thing. I can imagine Jesus' audience going, like, they're a breath intake, going, like, I can't believe he would say that. But here's what the father does. So his father agreed to divide his wealth between his sons. That's the second sentence of the story, and a little bit of cultural background that most people today wouldn't get. Okay, we're not talking about, you know, cashing in some RSPs. So I could imagine today somebody says to their parent, you know, I want to go make my own way in the world. I don't want to do things your way. And part of me really gets that. And so help me do that. So I can imagine somebody, you know, cashing in RSPs. This would be more than the equivalent of taking out a second mortgage on your home, because in that culture, your wealth is not held in cash. Your wealth is held in livestock and land. The two L's of Middle Eastern first century wealth. And so for him to divide his estate between his sons means you're going to get half the livestock and you're going to get half the land. Okay? So he divides his wealth between his sons. A few days later, this younger son packed all his belongings and moved to a distant land. For him to pack all his belongings, he has taken that half of the land he got and sold it, which is a big deal. It's not so big today. There are people that understand the value of land, but in a subsistence culture, your ancestral land is everything. That's what you pass on to your kids. That's what keeps your family going. There's your identity. And in that culture, so we're talking about a first century Jewish culture, there were all these strong personal identities of connection to your family, right? Well, the son is saying no to that. There's a connection to your lineage. The son says no to that. There's a connection to the land because in that covenant they had with God, this was the promised land. You don't give away your land and move away because you're moving away from that covenant, that nation agreement with God. And the son says, screw that, I'm going. I want to make my own way in the land, to a distant land. So he packed all his belongings, moved to a distant land, and there he wasted all his money in wild living. The original word there for wild living is the idea that living without any kind of restraint at all, either based on covenant or convention or morality. Regardless of what everybody expects of me, I'm just going to let it all hang out and go nuts. And so about the time his money ran out, So he's spending all of his money on everything. And here's where the word prodigal comes from, because the word prodigal doesn't mean the bad boy. The word prodigal means like lavish, somebody who spends to the excess, who lives to the excess. And so the word prodigal isn't actually in the original text at all. It's kind of imposed over the top. But here's why the son is called that. The one who goes to excess in how he lives. This is what the son does. Until all his money runs out. You know what's funny is when you have a lot of money, you tend to have a lot of friends. Sometimes when your money runs out, the people you thought were your friends also run out. And there's also something about having any kind of common sense or wisdom at all is like when I was young, I kind of hated this idea, and parents are always telling their kids, save something for a rainy day. And the rainy day hits at the wrong time. That's exactly what happens here. So it says, about the time his money ran out, a great famine swept over the land, and he began to starve. So the timing is bad. There's this coincidence here. And he's got no money, he's got no friends, and he's beginning to actually starve. And I can imagine Jesus' audience hearing this story and go, well, I understand the moral of the story. It's obvious at this point. If you do stupid things, it's going to catch up to you and serves you right. That's the obvious moral of the story. I mean, there are people that would say that to people in the world today. You had everything, you squandered it, look where you are now, that's your own fault. That's pretty obvious. So he persuaded a local farmer to hire him, and the man sent him into his fields to feed the pigs. In that culture, there were various statuses of people, and you had like the aristocracy at the top who tended to be wealthy, and it went on down to landowners that were subsistence farmers, and then you had your servants that were indentured servants. Their job was to live with a family and serve in whatever capacity. And at the very bottom rung, you had people that would be like day workers. So from day to day, you work and eat, or you don't work and don't eat. There's no job security here. On a daily basis, you get a job or you don't. Stand in the town square, somebody hires you. And so here's where he is. He's a day worker, he's starving. At the beginning of the day, standing in the town square, and some guy says, okay, come and feed my pigs. This is how far he is from home. Because in the Jewish culture, nobody's keeping pigs. They're like considered unclean. Like today, you know, practicing Jewish people don't eat bacon. And so he's so far from home that he's working for what he would see as a Gentile, a pagan, a heathen, and he's feeding these pigs are living better than him. Because it says the young man became so hungry that even the pods he was feeding the pigs looked good to him, but no one gave him anything. You're not going to eat the pig feed would be to steal from the guy that hired him. So the pigs are eating. He's got to wait for the end of the day to see how much he gets paid to see if he can actually eat. It says the pods he was feeding the pig. And my first thought is Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the old one. You know, the pod people. But there are these trees in the Middle East. They're carob trees, and it's almost like this giant bean that grows on it. And it's a very hardy plant. It can survive a famine. And so this is what is being fed to the pigs. And this guy's starving, watching the pigs eat. Now here's a profound sentence here, or part of a sentence. It says, when he finally came to his senses. The original words there in the original language isn't he comes to his senses. The original words is he came to himself. And there's a moment of, I think sometimes these are rare. I think we live unthinkingly a lot of the time. We're swayed by marketing, we're swayed by our appetites, and we're swayed by entertainment. We're swayed by our work requirements, we're swayed by our school requirements. And you go day by day by day. You know when you drive somewhere and then you wake up? You know, I don't remember driving here. Sometimes we live our lives like that. And there are moments where we come to ourselves. And it's like you can see yourself and say, what am I doing here? How did I get here? Here's where his consciousness is raised. And he can see himself objectively going, what the heck happened? What am I doing here? He said to himself, at home, even the hired servants have food enough to spare. Okay, you remember the day worker? Gets paid, you know, on a daily basis, just enough to survive. He's saying, even at home, the hired workers have more than enough to spare. This demonstrates that his father is a good man because his father is paying day workers enough that they have more to spare. That means they can get ahead in the world. His father's a good man, and this is what he realizes. At home, even the hired servants have food enough to spare, and here I am dying of hunger. I will go home to my father and say, Father, I have sinned against both heaven and you. I'm no longer worthy being called your son. Please take me on as a hired servant. At least I'll be able to survive. At least I won't starve, because I know that my father is a good man. So he packs up and goes home. He returned home to his father, and while he was still a long way off, you remember the moral of the story? The obvious moral of the story is serves you right. You got yourself in this situation. But it says, while he was still a long way off, his father saw him coming. You know why his father saw him coming? His father was looking for him. You can imagine his father like scanning the horizon, waiting for his son to come home. Filled with love and compassion, he ran to his son. You know, that sounds kind of neat. What we don't get is in that culture, the patriarch of the family is a man of honor. And a man of honor keeps his full body clothed all the time except for his hands and face. That means you don't run, because to run you have to uncover your feet, which would be dishonorable in that culture. But the father takes, he takes a position of dishonor to run to his son, lifts his robes and runs because he's so full of compassion. He embraced him and kissed him. That's a sign of restoration of belonging. You are no longer an outcast. You belong. His son said to him, Father, I have sinned against both heaven and you. I'm no longer worthy of being called your son. But his father said to his servants, quick, bring the finest robe in the house and put it on him. Get a ring for his finger and sandals for his feet. A robe, a ring, sandals. He's not just bringing him back into a place of belonging, but into a place of honor. These are status symbols, the robe, the ring, and the sandals. He's restoring him to status just like that. And kill the calf we have been fattening. We've been waiting for a party. Here's the party. We must celebrate with a feast, for this son of mine was dead and now has returned to life. He was lost and now is found. So the party began. So here's a story, here's a picture of this father. But Jesus tells a story to say this is what God is like. Sometimes we have an idea of God is somewhere between, you know, like Zeus hurling thunderbolts at people when they do something wrong, or Santa Claus who fulfills your wishes if you're good, and he knows who's naughty or nice, right? He's keeping a list, checking it twice. And so we have these images of God, and Jesus says, no, God is like a father who's waiting for his children to come home, who's waiting to run to them with open arms. And what does that look like? Well, it looks like in history, God himself coming to earth, humbling himself as Jesus, not taking the position of honor, but lifting his robe to run and his arms open wide. This is the story of Jesus coming to die for us, to make the way to God. Because honestly, here's what happens. Without Jesus doing that, we are trapped in our own subconscious living where we cannot come to ourselves and realize where we are. We don't have the ability to see God with his arms open wide. So Jesus came to break that darkness, to break that imprisonment, that spiritual imprisonment, so that we can come to ourselves. We can be elevated to a moment of consciousness and say, oh, that's what God is like. And he's waiting for us. And when we move towards him, he runs toward us. This makes all the difference in the world. This is why we do what we do. Because God is calling all humanity to be part of his family. Come home to me, be part of my family. I will welcome you with open arms. And how do you do that? Well, I'm going to tell you how to do that in a few minutes. But what I want to do first is show you a video of somebody who experienced that lostness and understood how to come back to God. So I want you to hear somebody else's story of this. Father is waiting. He's waiting to run to us with open arms, and you might say, well, how do I say yes to that? It's not easy, but it's simple. It's as simple as ABC. It's as simple as A, admit your need for him. Admit that you come to that point of consciousness, elevated consciousness, you come to yourself and say, I need him. I'm not making it on my own. Second thing is believe. Believe in that death and resurrection of Jesus that makes possible. And I mean, it's not about opinion, it's about trust. It's choosing to trust in the path that God has for us. And then the third one is commit your life completely to him. ABC, admit, believe, and commit. And so if this is you today, and I'm going to pray for you in a minute, but if this is you, you need to respond. And we have a couple of ways to respond here, to put action to this commitment. And the first, the easiest way is just text me. My number's on the screen. Say, I'm in. Give me your name. And then we can help you in this new spiritual journey. Second option is you take one of these Get Connected cards. We have them at the back of the theater. We have them in the lobby. Put out your name and a preferred method of contact. And on the back, there's a checkbox. I have decided to become a follower of Jesus today. And just check that. ABC, admit, believe, and commit. And then step into that. And if you're doing that for the first time today, I'd love to chat with you afterwards at the front here. And we're going to close off the service as I pray for you. Just come on up and I'll be waiting up here. I'm going to ask that you would stand this morning. And I'm going to pray for all of you. But don't walk away this morning and go back to the unconscious life. Don't go back to the meaninglessness of just the path of least resistance of work and entertainment and doing stuff and not living the life that your loving Father has for you. Father in heaven, I thank you so much that you want what's best from each of us or for each of us, and you both love us completely and have the ability to give us the life that we were created for. Father, I pray that you would crack through the doubt and the cynicism of those that are struggling with that decision right now. Father, pour out your love in a way that we know is real. It's not just about emotion or the mood or wishful thinking, but that touches us at the very core of our beings and brings us to life. Father, as we go from here, I pray that our spiritual eyes would be consistently open. We would see us as you see us. We would see the world as you see it. We would understand our place in the world as your child, as a part of your family. Thank you. In Jesus' name, amen.